Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
The key is, I don't care how shitty the place is, and I don't care how many people are there. The difference between pros and everybody else is, you don't get nervous, and you don't get lackadaisical. You get excited every time before you get up. You come in, you look at the room, you look at the people, and you build up some excitement inside yourself before you set foot out there. That's the key to everything, excitement.
So do you think this kind of intense environment that you were growing up in, do you think this helped with that crowd work which got you ready for the talk show?
You know what helped? My old man was great, man. My mother was the father and my father was the mother. My mother would kick the shit out of us at any given opportunity, you know what I mean? My father, different story. Come and talk to me. And my father allowed us to say anything we wanted. Like from the time we were five, my old man was say anything you wanted. You know, don't swear at the table, but this dinner table is for talking. You can say anything you want. And when you got three brothers, and you're competing for your 2 minutes of conversation time with your dad, it becomes a free-for-all, you know? And that's where it happens. You're Jewish, right?
Yeah.
Yes, you don't even know. Like, I've talked to a lot of comics, Leary too. He comes from an Irish family, and he said, that dinner table on Sunday night, man, you got the hook. It was the first place you got the hook. Like, if your mother and father turn and say, shut up, and your brother's got the stage now, you failed. That's what it was. It was like a comedy club. So he asked me to do it as a favor. Well, we're not on it. Maybe I should tell you when we're on. I'll tell you when I interview
you. We're
on. Are we on?
Yeah.
So 2 weeks ago, I opened for Randy Bachman, Bachman Turner Overdrive and the Guess Who, in a place called Grand Bend. I don't know. It's like the Martha's Vineyard of Canada. So this guy's
paying. So it's like the Bronx.
Yeah. So this guy's paying Randy Bachman $50,000 US, and the place holds 500 people and it's $40 a ticket. It's the same business model as you have, 120 people, $10 a ticket, $30,000 a month rent. I don't know how you do it.
Well, I don't know. As an owner of this place, I could say, do not invest in a comedy club,
right,
ever.
So this guy pays Randy to come. Randy's there with his son, Ty, who's had a couple of hit songs. So afterwards, Randy and I are sitting out back by the bus, and the owner comes out. And I said to the guy, listen, this place is must have cost you a fortune because it's a really historic place in Grand Bend. Like, all kinds of bands played there, like Rush in the 70s. So I said to the guy, geez, man, you must have paid a fortune for this building. He goes, well, I'm a Bitcoin guy. And I'll tell you, sorry, James, I know you love Bitcoin, but it's, every time I hear it and every time this a-hole I'm partnered with tries to mention paying me in it, I nearly punch him out. So we're standing by the bus, and the owner comes out, and he starts telling me, he goes, yeah, I just bought my third building here. And I go, oh, yeah, so what, Bitcoin? He goes, well, yeah, sort of. I go, yeah, sort of, right. You bought the three buildings off the old guy who owns the whole town, right? He goes, yeah. I go, you didn't pay that guy in Bitcoin, because if you tried to pay that guy in Bitcoin, he would have called the cops. And he goes, well, no, I sold enough Bitcoin to buy the buildings. So suddenly in my head, I'm going, okay, everybody's trying to explain it to me. It's a stock.
It's basically like a stock, or it's like a currency. You switch from Canadian currency to U.S. currency,
right,
when you buy a building.
So it's a stock. That's what I said to the guy. So it's a stock. You sold Bitcoin to buy something. So my response to him, who I'm partnering with, is you sell some Bitcoin and pay me. End of story.
It's a strategy. You could do that.
Yeah.
By way of intro, Mike Bullard.
It's Bullard, not Bullard.
Bullard.
Good research.
Bullard, I can't speak Canadian.
Let me explain it to you. Did you have, as a child, did you have a German Shepherd or a German Shepard?
I had neither.
Okay, all right.
But now I'll keep that in mind. You've been called the greatest TV talk show host in Canadian TV history.
Yeah.
You also did something like, how many years of radio? You did like...
10 years.
10 years of radio.
Yeah.
You've been a stand-up comic for 25 years or more.
Right.
And before that, you were a cop. Before that, you worked at, or after that, you worked at the phone company. Before that, you dropped out of school to become a cop and do stand-up.
That's right. That's right.
You have reinvented yourself so many times and from scratch, completely created new careers for yourself that were successful. Like, who goes from being a cop and then working at the phone company to be having the biggest talk show in Canada?
I didn't exactly leave the police force of my own volition.
No, but you left because this is what I admire. You left ostensibly because they didn't want you to do stand-up comedy on the side.
Jeez, you really do your research.
So
I was going to tell you, Jaywalker, shots fired, but yeah, your story's better.
Well, I think very few people, I think the common thing people do, and I'm always tempted to do this, is to keep doing the things I hate at the sacrifice of the things I love, because you think
right.
You have to do the things you hate because of family and responsibilities, and this is a safe,
yeah,
quote unquote, safe
that.
Job. It's very hard to make that leap so that you're not subtracting from the things you love to do more of the things
you, know how you, do
you
it?
Hate.
You realize you hate your family.
and then you have no more responsibilities.
You reinvent yourself and leave them. That's what you do.
Well, that is probably one valid technique. You shouldn't, you know, if things all work out and it's a decent split, you don't have to stay with anybody you don't want to stay with.
Right. Right.
So freedom is important.
Oh, huge.
And not at the expense of, you know, not being responsible, but at the same time, you only have one life. You can't spend 40 years of it with people you don't like living with.
Bingo. You've been divorced.
Twice.
Yeah, okay. It might be time.
We're on the same page.
After number two, it's time for a look in the mirror. I'm just saying.
Oh, believe me, I've had plenty of cracked mirrors, so I've looked at quite a few.
Okay.
So I don't even know where to start. Like, it's amazing each reinvention you did. Why did you join the police force?
When I was a kid, there was nothing but cop shows on TV, and I got sucked into the whole thing. And I loved it. And I thought, man, you join the police force, you become a detective, you solve murders. And then after you write your 50th ticket, you go, shit, this is all it's going to be.
Because it's just paperwork after that.
It's Canada. I mean, what are there, 10 murders a year? Chances of you getting involved in them are pretty slim. Plus, I realized after 2 years of being a cop, I'm the kind of guy who likes to mind my own business. And that's in direct contravention with the job.
And so at the same time, how did you get... So again...
Well, my brother was doing stand-up at Yuck Yucks,
mm-hmm.
which is probably the biggest comedy channel. Really, I know you've heard of Yuck Yucks.
Yeah, yeah. I watched you on the 25th anniversary of Yuck Yucks.
Right. Aaron probably told you about Yuck Yucks because he started there too. So I was writing for my brother, and then my brother took off for L.A., where he wound up. He and Norm Macdonald left together, and they became Tom Arnold saw them both in Las Vegas, and he loved them both so much. They were playing the same show that he hired them both to be writers on Roseanne. So my brother left. He didn't come back. And then I thought, shit, I got to start doing this myself. So in 88, I did my first amateur night.
Wow.
And then from there, it, you know, I had a couple of years there where they were giving me a hard time. There's nothing worse than your brother being a headliner and then you start doing amateur night. Because you always get an asshole MC who introduces you as Pat Bullard's brother instead of doing your name.
You know, it's interesting because I've interviewed Tony Rock, Chris Rock's brother, yeah. And we talked about this a little bit. He didn't seem to mind, but maybe it's because now it's 20 plus years into his career. He's got his own thing going, just like, you know, you do. And
Charlie Murphy. Look at Charlie Murphy.
Yeah, yeah. So I could imagine. But you know, you did well, ended up with your own TV show, which we'll get to eventually. But how was it? So you go up in 1988, you know.
You do your first 5 minutes, you kill.
Because all your friends are there for your first time.
Everybody's there. Your family, your friends. You go, Jesus, I'm fantastic. Now, your second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth time is where you separate the pros from living room funny. Because those other four or five times after that, you were going to bomb big time. And the same jokes you did that killed on your first night, you're sitting there scratching your head going, why didn't they work? I still remember the first two jokes I ever wrote.
What were the first two?
I'll tell you, this will be the first time I've ever used them since. And it'll be the last time.
Okay, 31 years later.
Yeah.
These jokes revived from the dead.
There's three, actually. One was, whittle the Japanese get a hold of bungee jumping, it'll be cordless. The second one was, do Eskimo cops feel foolish when they yell freeze? And I couldn't figure out why the second time it didn't kill. And the third one...
Why didn't it kill? I think that's funny.
You know what? Maybe it's funny now. I don't know. It didn't strike people as funny. You know, we got a lot of indigenous people. You know what I mean? Including Eskimos.
You know,
by the way, we don't call them Eskimos. I don't even know what the hell we call them, but I'm sure some of them were sitting there and didn't like it.
By the way, the President of the United States just tried to buy Greenland, which is all right. 56,000 Eskimos live there. That's the entire population of Greenland.
Yeah. He wanted to buy
Greenland.
He wanted to buy Iceland so you guys could get a deal on steam. That's how bright he is. Anyway, the third one was the one that made me, and I'll tell you why. The third one was the only way to kill a mime is to shoot him with a silencer. Stephen Wright was in the back of the room. 3 days later, my phone's ringing off the hook. 30 comics. Did you see Johnny Carson last night? Did you see Johnny Carson last night? So Stephen Wright did my joke on Johnny Carson. So everybody's phoning me going, you got to sue. You must be so mad. I went, fuck mad. I think I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
If Stephen Wright stole my joke, I know what I'm doing.
Well, let's talk.
And that gave me the confidence.
Yeah, because let's talk about that for a second. Like everyone, I feel like comedians, and not just comedians, I see this in every industry. People have a scarcity complex. They're like, oh my God, he said a few words that I've said. I'm never going to say good words again. So
right. He
needs to get in
you're
trouble.
You're afraid you're going to run out of stuff.
Right. People should realize if you have a sense of humor, every day you're going to have new ideas. Like you see comedians doing the same jokes for 40 years. Just have new ideas. Like, and like you say, you were an amateur night. Here's one of the best comedians ever did it on the Carson show the next day or the next week or whatever. That's enormous validation.
Yeah. And, the other guy, I know Steve Pearl, you know, Steve Pearl?
No.
He, wrote, Cocaine is God's Way of Telling You to Make Too Much Money.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've heard that joke.
Here's the deal with that. Robin Williams did it on his first Tonight Show appearance.
I think I've heard the show from Robin Williams.
So he has his agent call Robin Williams' agent. The next day, he sends Steve Pearl a check for $5,000 for one joke.
Wow.
Steve Pearl never cashed it. It's framed in a frame in his living room.
Good for him.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't cash the check. So that was kind of interesting. But anyway, once that happened, instead of me being pissed and bitter about it, it really built my confidence. And that's when I started winging it.
Winging it? What do you mean?
You know, here's the thing that influenced me more than anything else. Letterman never did anything but MC. The only time Letterman headlined, he bombed. And I heard him talk about this. And for actually my third year of doing my show, which I'll tell you about later, I had lunch with him. by the way, when I had lunch with him, you know what he said to me? I was doing a Canadian late night talk show. He said, keep it small as long as you can. I said, yeah, that's not going to be a problem. You know,
but you, just to say, you were beating him in the ratings in Canada.
Yeah,
they were airing a show in Canada around the same time.
Yeah, him and Leno. When I heard that, Toronto Life is a magazine that wanted to do a hatchet piece on me. And then when they got the ratings, I went from being on the cover to a little banner that said, guess who beats David Letterman in Canada? So they didn't even put my picture on the cover because now they couldn't do the hatchet piece, right? Anyway, where was I? I was talking about Letterman. Letterman only emceed. And when I was starting out, I saw an interview with Letterman, and he said, the happiest I ever was when I just emceed at the Comedy Store. So I went to Yuck Yucks and to Breslin, and I said, look, I just want to emcee. He goes, well, we got a lot of MCs, you know, and emceeing is worse than being a middle. It's the worst job. And I went, no, it's not. I want to do it. He goes, what do you want to do it for? I said, because I want to have a late night talk show. And the only way we get a late night talk show is to be truly spontaneous, listen to people, and come up with stuff like that.
Right.
I said, because that's the only way I'm going to get a late night talk show in Canada. They're not going to give me 21 writers. They're not going to give me 14 producers. I'm going to have to live by my wits, and I got to hone it. And he said, okay, go ahead, give it a shot. And that's all I've ever done.
Well, and I want to add, like, what distinguished your talk show was not just you doing a monologue, but you doing a monologue with crowd work. Like, you would, you know, I don't know of any other talk show that does that even now. Like,
3 years after I hit the air, Letterman started talking to the audience.
But I feel that was more scripted even. Like, he had the 21 writers.
I would say that too, James, but we had the same booker. In the third year, I got really lucky. Somehow, Letterman's booker took notice of us and offered to be the stringer down in the States to get us guests. And she's the one who said to me, you know, Letterman saw you doing some crowd work. And now he does a little thing with the crowd that he carries something over from the warm-up, and then he'll do it on the air, like mention somebody who said something to him during the warm-up. She said, he's doing that because he saw how well it's going over for you. I said, really? I said, that's pretty amazing. So,
can I add to this? Because I think this is such an important point, and I think about it a lot in terms of the difference between doing a set that you've written down maybe years before.
And honed like crazy.
Yeah, and honed like crazy with thousands of appearances on stage and doing crowd work. Crowd work is like magic. And the reason
if
why...
If it's done right.
Mm-hmm, if it's done right. And well, because I think there's two kinds of crowd work. There's the crowd work where it's completely improvised and riffed. There's also the crowd work where you can prepare and then you look for types in the audience to fit the crowd jokes you want to do.
Right.
And I think the crowd work that is totally spontaneous is amazing. And you're right. You have to learn that as an MC because, you know, I see thousands of MCs down here in this club. A bad MC just does their material.
Yeah.
And that does not warm up an audience that just walked in on the streets. They're ordering their drinks. You've got to engage the audience.
Two rules.
You've got to electrify them.
Two rules for being an MC. Be truly spontaneous or don't do it. And the second rule is don't throw an act under the bus. You're an asshole if you throw an act under the bus when you bring them out or when they leave.
Right.
That, to me, is the worst thing you can ever do. Because stand-up comics get so little respect that if we don't respect each other and don't prop each other up, who else is going to do it?
I agree with you. The one bad experience I've had as an MC is when a comic threw me under the bus.
They'll do that.
And I thought, okay, it's a joke. Then the next show, he did the exact same thing. He didn't watch my set or anything. He had just walked in when I announced him. And he was like a famous guy and it was a full crowd.
Yeah.
And it was just like a cheap... I thought it was like the hackiest way to get the crowd, you know, chuckling a little bit.
I had a guy, and I tell you who he was, but I can't remember his name, who came out once, and it was pretty sweet because I was pretty well known in Canada, and he came out after I introduced him and said, how about a big hand for what's his name? And the crowd turned on him, and he never got him back. So that was sweet revenge for me right in the moment.
Okay, can I tell you my revenge?
Yeah.
So the next show where I was also emceeing where he was, I found through crowd work, there was an opera singer in the back. So I had the opera singer come up on stage. There were two people who were celebrating birthdays. I had her sing in the most beautiful voice, her opera voice, you know, happy birthday. The audience was just fascinated and they loved it. And then I introduced immediately the comedian. So he had no energy from the crowd at all. They were all engaged with what had just happened and he fell flat immediately.
Yeah. So, it's great.
Yeah. That was,
and you deserved
I felt
it.
So good about that.
Yeah. The one case, the one exception for that for me was Eric Douglas, Kirk Douglas's son. Huh. Do you remember when this guy was a hobbyist in stand-up?
No.
Jesus. I was playing Montreal, the Comedy Nest, Ernie Butler's club. Probably outside of Yuck Yuck's, the best club in Canada. Crowds were fantastic. It's like, because you're doing it in English, and people in Montreal are English-starved, so they're ecstatic to be there in the first place, so you got two strikes right out of the way. Because, you know, it's against the law to have English signage in Montreal, in Quebec.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Hey,
they don't have both?
I'm going to fill you in on Canada, this sweet, beautiful place.
See, I didn't do my research on I should have researched every city of Canada first.
Yeah, well, in the U.S., they stab you in the front. In Canada, they stab you in the back, but that's a whole story. So anyway, I'm playing Montreal, and Eric Douglas is there. This is the guy who died of a coke overdose, right? And normally I feel bad for people who die of a coke overdose, but this guy was so big an asshole that when he died, I felt the same way as I did when Johnny Versace died. Because I bought a Johnny Versace shirt once and the button fell off and they wouldn't give me my money back.
So
when Johnny Versace died, I was like, good. Anyway, Eric Douglas eventually died of a coke overdose. But I'm in the green room at the Comedy Nest with a bunch of other guys who are great comics. Norm MacDonald was there. I was there. It was before Norm left for L.A. So we're sitting back there, and Eric Douglas is acting like he owns the club. He's acting like he's 10 times better. We've never seen the guy in our lives. So Eric Douglas goes, what's your name? I said, I already told you three times. Mike. Yeah, Mike, when you introduce me, don't mention my father and don't mention my brother. I go, what, that's the only ground rule? He goes, yeah. You know, just say how great I am and bring me out. I go, that's it. He goes, yeah. I go, okay. So when I introduced him, I said, please welcome son of Spartacus. And that's the only time I ever did it. And the guy deserved it. And he went out and he bombed big time.
So wait, you say, I agree with the advice, don't throw the act under the bus. And I also agree with your two anecdotes, but clearly, you don't always follow the advice. Like, what?
That was a one time.
And let me ask you this, because I think there's a third rule, which is there's a fine line between spontaneous and MCs kind of tucking in their act into their MC set, you know, when they're trying to warm up the audience.
That's why the best MCs are guys who've never done anything else.
That's probably true.
Richard Belzer.
Yeah.
All he ever did was MC.
Or there was a guy at the Comedy Cellar who in New York here who just MC'd for years and didn't really do sets. But right. I mean, I think doing sets helps you with a different type of responsiveness to the crowd too.
Yeah.
That helps with MC. But I think like when people come to see me when I'm doing an MC set versus a regular set, I tell them it's not my stand-up set. It's a completely different experience.
Right.
As the MC, you're trying to tribe build the crowd. You have to really engage with them so that it's better for them than watching a YouTube video.
You know what it is, though, James? You got to know when to get out. You got to know when to stop. Like, the most pressure I was ever under was CTV is like the equivalent to ABC in the U.S., and I had a one-hour comedy special, and I didn't write anything for it. It was at the Opera House in Toronto, which holds about 800 people. So that was the most pressure I ever felt in my life because it was 6 months before my late night talk show debuted. And I'll never forget this. I'm supposed to do 40 minutes so they can cut in commercials. So I go, shit, I can do 40 minutes. It's going to take me 40 minutes to say hello. This is going to be great. Well, then the head of the network comes in and he walks up to me and he goes, 10 minutes before I go on, you know what? Go up there and have fun. Do an hour and a half. Go up there and have fun. Do an hour and a half with five cameras on you. And I'm going, Jesus, are they going to edit this? What are they going to do? So I went up and did the hour and a half. And I did I forget what I did. Somewhere through the middle, I did something with a guy. And then at the end, I ended it with the guy. And I don't know if the crowd was more amazed by the joke or the fact that 90 minutes later, I still remembered the guy's name and what he did.
And it's a nice callback.
Guy was a dentist. And I set it up with a guy, making fun of all the jazz. And then I ended the special with, I was at my dentist last week. I had a root canal No pain at all. A guy knocked me out, gave me gas. Then I got home and noticed my underwear was on backwards. Night. And that was it. That's how they ended the special.
That's funny. Yeah. So when you're doing the crowd work, and again, this was a hallmark of your later TV show. This is a big part of your stand-up. Aaron Berg, who I consider the god of crowd work here in New York, complimented you. He said he learned his chops from you. When you're saying you're going to be spontaneous, what does that mean? Like, how do you practice that muscle?
You don't. You practice it. I'll tell you how you practice it. This is a good question. Mm-hmm. You practice it all day long with everybody you bump into. I stopped at a barber shop on the way here, and my goal was to walk in, talk to the three barbers about a haircut, make them laugh for like 2 minutes, and then leave. At the hotel this morning with the girl behind the front desk, who seemed to be the coldest human being on earth, I stood there until I cracked her, and then I went and had breakfast. Then when I went and had breakfast, I talked to the waiter about New York for a while. We had a couple of good jokes between us, and that's how you hone it. The second thing is no booze, no drugs. Not ever. I got drunk when I was 18, threw up the lining of my lungs the next day on 151 proof rum, never drank again.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, never drank again. I come from a long line of Irish alcoholics, too. Christ, these people blow up their own cars.
So, you think the booze or the drugs would stop the spontaneity?
I know at least four guys who died. Hmm. Mike McDonald, you know who Mike McDonald was?
Mm-mm.
Really? You guys don't?
Yeah, no.
You talk to any comic in New York, they'll worship him.
Did he start McDonald's? I'm practicing.
Yeah. Things were never the same after he left his brother. Mike was probably the Dennis Leary of Canada. Okay? Or should we say Bill Hicks? Okay, Bill Hicks. So, Mike, a lot of heroin, a lot of booze, got a liver transplant. And stopped doing everything, but sadly, he died 2 years ago. And there were guys like him. There were other guys I knew who committed suicide. My thing was, give me my money. I'm going to the ATM, and I'm going home. That was my thing.
I mean,
soft drinks were free. I got 50% off the food. The most I ever owed at the end of the night, not including tipping out the waitresses, which I always did. Tipping out the waitresses is something you should always do. Because if you tip out the waitresses, they're going to be as quiet as jungle cats when they serve the table when you're performing, you know what I mean? You don't tip out the waitresses, they're going to drop a glass. So these guys were sticking around till 3 in the morning. Here's the Ernie Butler story. I wanted to tell you this story. Ernie Butler on the Comedy Nest. I killed there, but he hated my guts. You know why? Because I didn't drink and I didn't do drugs. Because here's how Ernie Butler paid you. Every night, if you had a killer show, Ernie invited you up to his inner sanctum, the office, and Ernie laid out a mile-long line of coke on the desk. You did great. You want some coke? Sure. Then at the end of the weekend, you went up to get paid. Okay, I owe you $86 because you snorted $400 worth of coke. Bye. Hated me because it would be, I owe you $800. That's right. You owe me $800. Give it to me. So that really pissed him off. And I used to take great joy in that, the fact that he had to actually pay me at the end of the weekend. To me, that was sweet, you know, because I walked out with the money.
And so, but obviously he kept asking you to come back to MC, so that you were creating the value.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm fascinated with all the reinventions and all the different arcs in your career, but I really am...
You know, sorry, go ahead.
I really am particularly interested right now in this... I was just having this, it's so funny we're talking about this because I was just having this conversation this morning with another friend of mine who's a comedian. There are some comedians that they go up there, they do their act, they get off, and you could tell it was just an act. They have no sense of humor, whatever. Other people are just on and on and on. They're on all the time. And they can do that they have an act, but then you could see all throughout their act, they're intermingling. The crowd is spontaneous. They're riffing. They've got zingers in between every half joke, and it's amazing.
It's great you said that, because there's two kinds of comedians: comics and monologists. And there's a huge difference between a comic and a monologist. A comic is naturally funny, has been his entire life or her life. Notice how I threw in her.
2019, man.
Yep. And a monologist is a guy like Jerry Seinfeld, who I played with in Niagara Falls once, New York. and I could hear him typing in his room all day before he went on that night. And that's a monologist.
Okay, but I admire that discipline too. I mean,
well, unbelievable.
Yeah, the guy was probably writing 50 jokes, maybe every 1,000 jokes, he picked one. And yep. That's no easy skill either.
The other thing he was doing was he's playing a shitty comedy club in Niagara Falls, and he's got 5 suits. Like, you know, you get over the thrill of travel after your first year. Like, I remember starting out carrying 2 suits and a sports jacket and a shirt and a tie and being all excited about, oh, I get to get dressed up and I get to perform in front of you. Now, maybe a Harley t-shirt and this, and a couple of shirts to change into and 2 pairs of underwear. That's the other thing that happens, you know?
Well, so with the, like, did you ever find, like, okay, let's say you're MC 50 times, 100 times, and of course, in the course of that, with each MC set, you're interacting with 10 to 20 people. Do you find that you internally categorize different types of people? Like, oh, here's this category. I can pull out these jokes I've used in the past. So you start to get a language of spontaneity.
You get to the point where you hope that you never heard of the job this person does when you talk to them, because you want to come up with something. And you don't want to be lazy. You don't want to go, you know, the guy's an accountant. I mean, I've dealt with accountants before. I don't want to do the same joke.
You're like, what would you, okay, let's say some guy's an accountant in Kazakhstan. What, like, it sounds so boring, both words, accountant and Kazakhstan. What would you, I'm not putting you on the
spot. I'll tell you what happened.
How would you think about it?
I'll tell you what happened. I was there one night, and a guy said he was a forensic accountant. And I said, a forensic accountant? What's that, an accountant who solves the murders of other accountants? And the guy went nuts. And then 2 years later, another forensic accountant, and it's the only time I ever did it. I went, I got to use that joke again. I haven't used that joke in 2 years, and it's such a great joke. And because of all these Forensic Files TV shows and shit, people went insane.
And so even coming up with that, like my first thing was, okay, you start branching off from the words he's saying. So, okay, does he just do the taxes of dead people or,
yeah,
you know, but that was a twist that you did where I didn't consider in the split second we had of like, oh, what do you do? You know, solve the murders of dead accountants or whatever you said. So again, is that just, you know, how much did you build that muscle up through experience? How much was it kind of like a natural?
The key is, I don't care how shitty the place is, and I don't care how many people are there. The difference between pros and everybody else is you don't get nervous and you don't get lackadaisical. You get excited every time before you get up. You come in, you look at the room, you look at the people, and you build up some excitement inside yourself before you set foot out there. That's the key to everything. Excitement.
How do you build up that excitement if you're a naturally nervous person?
Well, I'm not a naturally nervous person, so, you know, I mean, for me, it was all around our dinner table. I mean, that's where it all happened. Our dinner table was a competition when I was a kid.
Right.
Who's funnier? So I never got nervous, even from the first time I ever went on.
But at the dinner table or at the diner you ate out this morning or whatever, you could say stuff. There's not an audience. Some things will hit. Some things will make the waitress funny. It's a little bit of a captive audience. When you're up on stage, the slight difference is that your job is to warm up the crowd. There may be 50 to 1,000 people in there and or 10 to 1,000 people in there. And, you know, if someone says something boring and you can't think of something in the first second or two, you kind of have to move on. And so you need a bunch of tricks for moving on.
Moving on is just moving on. That's what I do. I just move on.
And that could be funny too. It's like, okay.
It could be funny. Really?
Yeah.
There's nothing there. Bye.
Right. Or I didn't hear what you just said, so I'm just moving here.
And it's the mic, it's the light, it's the smell when you walk in. You talk to anybody who's good at it, anybody who really does it, and they'll tell you that. My favorite smell in the world is walking into a dank comedy club. You know, the stale beer. And even though I don't drink, the stale beer, the must off the carpet, depending upon how far down in the bowels of a building the place is, and it just does something to you. It just does something to you. It's like a smell, I don't know, that somebody gets when they get to work that they really enjoy, like a guy who's baking bread. for me, it's the same deal. When I walk in there and smell that, I just go, I got to have this.
Do you think that's why, like, no matter who I speak to on this podcast, no matter how far they've risen in the TV world or movie world,
and
I've had some huge stars on, and they always say their true love is stand-up. There's this addictive quality. And what is it? Is it that direct interaction with the crowd? Is it,
yeah.
when you say creating excitement, are you excited for yourself? Are you excited that you're going to provide this gift to the crowd? And maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, what is that?
You just wrote, produced, and starred in a show that was completely dependent upon you. You didn't have to count on a camera guy getting the right shot. You didn't have to count on a producer going out and getting you the right things you needed, the tools you needed to do your job that night. It all comes down to you. You know, like when they say one-man show, stand-up's a one-man show. Stand-up's a one-woman show. Did it again. It's a one-person show. You're in complete control. Nobody's going to grab you and go, stop now. Nobody's going to say, you can't say that, because you just said it. It's too late. It came out of your mouth. And it's hit the audience, and it's come back to you in laughter. So, too bad. It's done.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like, in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like, the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, good things come to those who wait. I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle. Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
So this is a very, what I call, choose yourself kind of definition of what you're doing. If everybody in the world is saying, no, Mike, you can't do a show. You got to get an agent. You got to get a TV producer. You got to get a TV network. And then we'll consider you and we'll promote you or cancel you, whatever. You're basically saying, hey, I want to have my own show. Right. I'm going to go up on stage tonight and do a show.
You know how I did it? You know who the CBC is, right?
Yeah.
It's like the BBC in Britain.
I have been on CBC.
Okay. Where were you? What were you on?
I was on a business show.
Okay. So I was on the CBC. They were doing comedy specials. It was called Comics. So the first year, I didn't get one. And CBC was going, well, you MC. And then the second year, the other comics were going, why doesn't Mike Bullard have one? How come he hasn't had one? So the third year, they gave me one. So what I did was I gamed them like they've never been gamed ever. You had to do 15 minutes. You had to do half an hour stand-up. It was a one-hour special. And you had to do CBC, such bullshit. You had to do a half hour of something else. Well, wait a minute. I'm not a sketch guy. What's this half hour of something else? They said, well, you can do sketches. You can do a funny little short film. I go, I'm not interested in doing any of those things. They said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to do a parody of a talk show. That's a great idea. So I go, they go, what do you want? I said, I need two of your most famous Canadian TV personalities, and I'll do interviews with them. They said, what a great idea. I said, I know, it's a great idea. So I did it, and I took it to a competing network and said, I want a late-night talk show.
And that's how you got the show.
I did a legitimate half-hour late-night talk show, and all you had to do was use the word parody with CBC, and those idiots up top didn't even notice.
And in the interviews, were they parody interviews, or did you do serious interviews?
I just did real interviews with two guys. One was like a Neil deGrasse Tyson of Canada, science guy. Had a barrel of laughs with him.
So he's like a high school physics teacher?
And the other guy was like the Walter Cronkite of Canada, Knowlton Nash. He was our most famous news anchor. Huh. Did one with him, made him funny, made the second guy, Bob McDonald, funny. Took it to CTV, and they said, wow, this is great. I said, yeah. So I think it was probably a $100,000 demo tape that they paid me to do. It was the most beautiful thing ever.
It reminds me of, you know, Eric Andre? He has the... He kind of has a parody talk show.
Yeah.
And I love it how from what I understand, I don't know if this story is true or not, but he basically wanted to do a talk show. So he just got some space at the back of some bodega, called publicists and said, I have a real talk show. And they sent over some movie stars. And he did these completely insane parody interviews. And then Adult Swim picked it up. And so I like that, you know, it's sort of like you allow... Again, you don't let them choose you. You choose yourself and do it. People don't understand. They think they need to like do X, Y, and Z, or they need to have certain credentials or degrees or whatever. You can just do something, and that's the best proof that you can do it.
Now, 20 years ago, like social media wasn't what it is.
Right.
No, right?
Now what you did was incredible.
Yeah.
If you just did it in your backyard, CTV wouldn't have looked at it.
Nope. And now that's what I had to do. That's what I had to do because if a network didn't do it, you weren't going to get it done.
But I think this underlines the importance of doing versus like, oh, I've been a stand-up for this many years. Let me try out for you so you could pick me.
Right.
You picked yourself to actually do something, and that was the thing you wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah. It was, I couldn't believe it. I mean, that was my first dealing with television executives. And I remember going, Jesus Christ, this is what I should have done. I should have become a television executive. These guys are stupid.
And then, so CTV offers you this deal to
do. What happened was all of a sudden, they opened the floodgates in Canada for specialty TV channels. So you guys had Comedy Central down here. CTV got the license for the Comedy Network. This is a good story, too. So they get the license for the Comedy Network. And I bring them this tape, and they give me this Comedy Now special. Well, after the Comedy Now special, they were ecstatic and said, you know, you're so good off the cuff. We are going to give you this late-night talk show. And I went, great. So what happened was I was on the Comedy Network only, right, which was really small. but I wanted to be on the main network, CTV. I wanted to be on that main network so bad I could taste it, because I knew that's where I was going to get a half decent living wage. Not a, you know, Comedy Network, I was never going to make any decent money.
Can you tell me, like, on the Comedy Network, A, what were they paying, and B, what were the numbers like? What were the ratings like?
I was doing about 100,000 people a night on the Comedy Network.
That's great.
In Canada, it's huge.
Yeah.
You know, if you're on Canadian television for 7 years, that's like dog years in the U.S. That's like 49 years in the U.S. If you can pull off 7 years in Canada, that's the equivalent to pulling off Johnny Carson years in the U.S. Because everybody hates people who do well in Canada. Every Canadian hates, you know, somebody who's doing well and is well-known, unless you're a newscaster. That was the saddest thing. Newscasters were the biggest stars in Canada for 50 years. It was sickening. Anyway, so I'm on the Comedy Network. I'm not on the main network. Then TV Guide, remember that? Anybody here? Anybody? Bueller, anybody? Remember TV Guide? So TV Guide says they want to do a cover story on the show. And they go, but we can't do a cover story on the show because the Comedy Network isn't on in Manitoba or Quebec. So an executive at CTV goes, well, we want him to get the TV Guide cover story. We should put him on CTV. And that's how it happened. They put me on 11:30 at night on CTV just so I could get the cover of TV Guide for a story. And then the numbers came in the first week, and I was beating Letterman and Leno, and they left me on CTV.
What were the numbers? So if 100,000 on the Comedy Network.
Was doing 275 at midnight.
Wow.
275 at midnight. Leno and Letterman were doing like 140 each.
Wow, so you basically got them combined.
It was almost for the first couple of years, yeah. And I was shocked, man, because I got to tell you, I was not getting big stars. The guy who broke my star cherry was Dennis Leary, and I'll always love him for doing it. I worked with him in Rochester 25 years ago, and he was in Toronto, and he actually phoned me up and said, how come you haven't asked me to be on your show? I went, I didn't know you were here. Dennis Leary comes on, and all of a sudden, every so-called famous Canadian wanted to be on the show the next day after Dennis Leary came on. But the funniest moment for me, and the reason I always stayed humble, one night I got this actor on from a CBC show, and I throw to an Advil commercial, and he's in it. That, to me, was so Canadian. There's nothing more Canadian than that. That never happens in the U.S., where you throw to a commercial, and the guy who's your main guest that night is on the commercial.
Why do you think it doesn't happen in the U.S.? Do you think they kind of scan for that? Like,
I think that it's all about star power on a talk show, right? Especially now with so many of them. Like, somebody asked me, would you like to do it today? I said, nope.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because the talk show format, I feel, is kind of dying right now. Like, there got to be too many talk shows and none of them are really doing great. I mean, you could say, argue Jimmy Fallon because of that particular position is great. And also, he's mastered a way to take segments and put them on YouTube.
Right.
He kind of instinctively...
And Colbert's doing great, but if Trump ever turns into a human being, Colbert's going to be canceled.
Yeah, and I'm not saying the other talk shows are necessarily bad, but there's so much content out there that's not live, that's great, you know, that you could choose to watch instead of tonight's, you know, late night with whoever. There's less incentive to turn on, oh, I got to see the late night show of the day.
And then you're not even throwing in Comedy Central.
Right.
I mean, you throw in Samantha Bee and Trevor Noah, and gee, man, there's just, you know, it's like there's 10 of them.
Yeah.
And I always go, wow. And you know, and you can always tell, too, when somebody's opening a movie, like it opened last week, and the one of the leads was on Kimmel on Monday and Colbert on Friday. The one that cracks me up is they all crack me up because they all act like they're big supporters of each other. You ever notice that?
Yeah.
Colbert will give Fallon a compliment on the air, and Fallon will give Colbert a compliment on. Bullshit. You'd kill this guy if you thought you could get away with it. Like, you'd kill the guy. There's no way. There's no way these guys are that supportive of each other, because I've done it, and I know you are not friends.
Right, because it's if someone's not watching you, they're watching the other
guy. It's like Clooney and Pitt, right? Clooney's got to stand on an orange crate. Pitt is 6'1". There's nothing Clooney hopes for more than Pitt getting his legs amputated in a motorcycle accident.
So you're doing this late night show. This is 9 years in or 8 years into your comedy career, right? Is when you first started doing
it. Yeah, you know what? I started in 88 and show went on the air in 97.
Yeah, so, and do you think it took you, like, that was a good kind of warming up period, like that many
Perfect.
Years of crowd work and
you know, I had a full-time job right up till 6 months before the show debuted.
Yeah, you're working for Bell.
Yeah, corporate investigations.
Well, what's that like? Like what would be an investigation?
65,000 people, embezzlement. I was in charge of interrogation.
Like, what would they embezzle? Like, an employee would embezzle?
Contractor kickbacks. I got a guy for $12 million my last year there.
Wow, so an executive at Bell would hire someone to build out some kind of infrastructure?
What happened was this guy was not even a mid-level manager. He made $90,000 a year. And the thing that twigged everything was an employee went to his house for a Christmas party. The guy's living in a $1 million house. There's a Range Rover and a Mercedes in the driveway. So I get a call on the Monday from somebody going, this guy's wife is a teller at the bank. And I know how much he makes because we have the same job. So first thing you do is check for inheritances. There were none.
How do you check for that?
There's ways to go about it. It's a matter of public record in Canada where you can go to an archive and you can look it up, like wills, all kinds of shit. Look up the guy's name. Took forever. And the other one was, did he win the lottery? And that was a simple call to an investigator at the Lottery and Gaming Commission who told me no. So then the guy, what he was doing was, Northern Telecom was one of the biggest suppliers of telephone equipment in the world, and we owned them. So instead of buying computer patch cords from Northern, this guy goes to some rinky-dink company outside of Toronto, and he's buying the patch cords off this guy. So I go, why the hell is he buying patch cords off this guy when we own Northern Telecom? And he's buying them to the tune of like $4 million a year. So then right away I go, well, obviously the guy's giving him a kickback. So the kickback wound up being about $12 million.
Oh my gosh, how many years have you been doing it?
The guy had been doing it for about 5 years. So I call him in to interrogate him. And because he's an employee, it's not a criminal charge yet. So, you know, he's on the clock, right? He's being paid. So, you know, he can't leave the room. You got him in there and you're sweating him. And you don't even let him leave to go to the bathroom. The key is a big bottle of water in front of the guy and no access to a bathroom. If you got to take a piss, you'll confess to the Sharon Tate murder. If you got to, I swear to God, no matter, you can beat some, like cops talk about beating people up all the time, getting a confession. If a guy's got a piss, he'll confess to anything. The great train robbery, it doesn't matter. He's got to take a piss. So this guy had a big bottle of water in front of him. His bladder was about to explode. Then he confesses to the whole thing. So I let him go to the bathroom, and the company wanted his balls. I mean, they wanted him in jail. So we used Chubb, right, for forensic accounting. And
so you're saying finally he confessed?
He confessed the whole thing.
Why wouldn't he just say no or I need a lawyer?
He can't ask for a lawyer. You haven't charged him with anything. He's on company time and he's being paid, so he can't ask for a lawyer. The lawyer comes when you call the police and it's wrapped in a red ribbon and you hand it to him and they arrest him. That's what happens at the end. So we got his house, we got his cars, we got his bank accounts, and he had $6 million in the Cayman Islands.
Did you get that?
Yeah. Took him down on the company jet, got the money back. So he stole 12. By the time we sold the house, the cars, and his stocks, and got the money back to the Caymans, we got $14 million back. So the company comes to me and goes, what should we do with the guy? I said, well, we would have flushed that money down the toilet in a year.
Yeah,
we got $14 million.
Put him in charge of the pension fund.
Yeah, I said, we should give him a merit award. And they go, what are you kidding? And I go, well, no, we got to send him to jail. But I'm just telling you, we should put the guy in charge because we're getting $14 million back on $12 million stolen. Nobody gets $14 million back. And they're going, are you serious? They were so pissed at me. And I go, look, I'm just kidding, okay? We're going to call the cops. So the funny part to me was the guy wound up in a penitentiary in Ontario. And 6 months later, I got a late night talk show. So all I was doing was picturing this guy sitting in the common room with all these guys.
I know that
watching
guy.
Me on TV going, who is this guy? I know this guy from somewhere. Who is this guy? That cracked me up.
So given that he was going to go to jail anyway, he didn't try to, you know, kind of pretend the $6 million wasn't there, like, oh, I lost that, or...
Nope. No pretending. I tell you, he had to take a piss so bad. I mean, cops kill you. They tell you these stories about how I solved this, how I solved that. Full bladder will solve anything. I'm telling you, guys, I don't know about women, because women don't steal, by the way. That's one thing I learned over the course of time. Women do not steal money. You know, they'll fuck up your whole life, but they won't steal your money. They won't. If they're a CEO, they will not steal money. They're always honest. I've never heard of a female CEO going to jail. But with guys, I tell you, once
Martha
that bladder...
Martha Stewart.
Yeah, what'd she do, though?
Yeah, I agree.
It cost
you.
Her more money to land that plane
right.
than she made on that right, stock, right? And I'm not one for feeling sorry for Martha Stewart, because I met her once and there was nothing behind those eyes. Nothing. Like dead. It's like Celine Dion's husband. Two people I met who had no soul. Martha Stewart and Celine Dion's husband.
It's like obscure.
When you meet a brown-eyed person and there's nothing warm in their eyes, run as far and as fast as you can. And that's how I felt about Martha Stewart and him. But yeah, full bladder, you're going to confess to anything.
So you already knew in advance, this guy definitely did it.
You got to know first.
Yeah.
You got to know going in.
So it wasn't like you kind of read whether he was lying or not.
No.
Not like you played him in any way.
No.
It's just you kind of waited him out.
If a cop ever calls you in and says to you, here's another one. I shouldn't be giving this away, but if a cop ever calls you in and you're sitting down and goes, do you know what you're here for? Your answer should be, no idea. None. What am I here for? If you say to somebody, what are you here for? You'd be amazed at how many things they confess to that you didn't even know. The thing you know about, they won't mention, but there'll be two other things they'll bring up. It's incredible.
Well, what's another tip for all our criminal listeners?
Get mad. Anybody accuses you of anything, go psychotic.
You know, it's interesting because I was just reading, so Malcolm Gladwell has this
and
new
don't,
book.
Oh, by the way, one more thing. Don't blame somebody else. The thing they're looking for, especially in business, if you've embezzled, they're looking for you to say, no, I don't know anything about it, but I'm pretty sure that guy at the desk next to me does. As soon as you do that, they know you're guilty. If you put it on somebody else, they know you did it.
Why is that?
Because that's what a sociopathic type will do. They'll put it off on somebody else.
I was just reading so Malcolm Gladwell has this brand new book, Talking with Strangers, and basically saying that nobody, the police, the CIA, the FBI, no judges, nobody can really determine if someone's telling the truth. And they use the Amanda Knox case. I don't know if you remember that.
She's, yeah.
That basically, because she looked guilty, like she would not look
right. She gave off all the earmarks of it.
Right. So everybody just assumed she was guilty because she didn't look like an actor on TV who's
right.
innocent, but being accused of something. She looked like Amanda Knox
yeah.
and her personality, however yeah. that was. They automatically assumed she was guilty, and there was this huge, you know, it was a huge case.
The other thing is they talk about kinesic interview technique. I read a book on kinesic interview technique. How do I know the guy I'm interviewing didn't read a book on kinesic interview technique? That's why kinesic interview technique makes me laugh.
What is it? I don't even know what that is.
It's all the signs people give off when they're lying. Well, if the guy who's lying read it, then he's, you know.
Wait, doesn't he's gonna
make Dave you
Chappelle
look like
just a has a joke like that in Sticks and Stones, in his new special, where he's like, why are the kids going to these special classes on what to do
right.
if there's a shooter in the building? Isn't the shooter in that class also?
Yeah, but I did an interview on kinesic interview technique 2 years ago, and I already said that formula. And I didn't make it a joke, so
don't
jump on me.
That's funny. Yeah. So, what about, like, do you believe in kind of these microfacial expressions?
No, you know what? You know, the only thing you can believe in is the confession. I said that to somebody once. Unless they tell you they did it, unless you get them to a point where they're going to tell you, you can't trust anything. Like, what's this crap about? I remember my old man going, when you shake a man's hand, you give him a firm handshake. And if he doesn't give you one back, don't do business with him. Well, what if his dad, who was a sleazeball con artist, said to him, make sure you give a guy a firm handshake when you want to steal all his money? Like, you know, that stuff we learned as kids is all bullshit.
I love how you sound like an Irish cop and like
My whole family's Irish. My family's Irish.
And then meanwhile, you've basically been a stand-up comedian for 30 years and talk show host and all these things.
You're Jewish, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you don't even know what revenge prone is. My uncle went to his brother's funeral. My aunt was crying like crazy, missing the guy. My uncle walked in for 5 minutes and went, "I just came to make sure he's dead," and turned around and walked on his heel and walked out. That's the kind of people I come from.
So, okay.
My grandfather was a heavyweight boxing champion in the military. I remember my dad saying to me, only a coward hits a woman, except for your grandfather. He just hits everybody. And if his wife happens to be in the way when he's trying to get at a guy, so be it.
Oh, my God.
That's the kind of guy he was, you know?
So do you think this kind of intense, almost, nothing held back environment that you were growing up in, do you think this helped with that crowd work, which got you ready for the
You know what helped? My old man was great, man. My mother was the father and my father was the mother. My mother would kick the shit out of us at any given opportunity, you know what I mean? My father, different story. Come and talk to me. And my father allowed us to say anything we wanted. Like I'm not kidding, from the time we were five, my old man was, "Say anything you want. You know, don't swear at the table, but this dinner table is for talking. You can say anything you want." And when you got three brothers and you're competing for your 2 minutes of conversation time with your dad, it becomes a free-for-all, you know? And that's where it happens. Like, I've talked to a lot of comics. Leary, too, he comes from an Irish family, and he said that dinner table on Sunday night, man, you got the hook. You know what I mean? It was the first place you got the hook. Like, if your mother and father turn and say, "Shut up," and your brother's got the stage now, you failed. That's what it was. It was like a comedy club.
You know, it's so interesting because, you know, you said about, you know, before you get on stage, whether it's stand-up or MC or whatever, you get yourself very excited. And I don't know if you mean that you kind of...
envision.
Yeah, what do you envision? Like, what do you...
I envision killing. I've told other guys that. Uh-huh. Envision killing. Don't envision, oh my God, I'm looking at that guy over there. I can already tell that guy doesn't like me.
Right.
Envision.
So it's almost like this inner game of tennis kind of thing, or Zen and the Art of Archery. Like, you kind of picture it, that you're up there, everyone's laughing. What else?
You got to...
I mean, some people tell me, again, it's like what I said earlier, like, some comedians will say they envision that they're giving this gift. They have the ability to give this gift of laughter to the audience, and that fuels them.
You know how they say there's... not a lot of difference between a CEO and a sociopath. You know how they say that?
Yeah. Well, most CEOs probably are sociopaths.
And they talk about most sociopathic professions. I mean, I've seen entertainers in there, but I've never seen comics, because really what you're doing is, you're not committing a crime, but you're manipulating in a small club, 120 people, in a theater, 1,000 people. You're really manipulating their minds. You're bringing them around to your point of view, whether they know it or not. And, I mean, it's like saying you can use this power for good or you can use this power for evil. So I decided to use it for good by becoming a stand-up comic. Otherwise, I would have done something else where I Ponzi schemed somebody out of every penny they had, right? Plus, comics have no business sense. You know that.
Well, depends. Some of the ones with $60 million Netflix specials probably have more than the average person who performs down
here. And by the way, I'm going to tell you something about that. Dave Chappelle and Bill Burr. Love them both. Met them both. Love every word that comes out of their mouths. Every thought process, every word. Norm Macdonald last week said, if you don't love what the Peerless One did on Sticks and Stones, and you're a comic, quit. And he's right, what they did.
I agree.
Yeah. What they've done is they've taken that social justice... I was telling Eric and Jay, they've taken that social justice warrior car and they shoved it over the cliff.
Well, and also, if you look at... First off, the first sign is... On Rotten Tomatoes, he has a 0% critic score and a 99% audience score.
Right.
So all the articles that say this was unfunny and boring. Well, look at the audience while he's talking. They're 100% laughing. Second off, they all were excited enough. In other words, they weren't bored. They gave him a rating on Rotten Tomatoes of 99%. So you know that every professional writer commenting is wrong.
Dead wrong. Vice, I love the way the guy in Vice reviewed him and then got attacked by like 1.1 million people. That's when I went, well, I'm watching Twitter and I'm going, holy shit, it's over. It's this close to being over. Then I watched Bill Burr's Paper Tagger the night it came out and went, it's over. It's over, thank God. It's over here. It's not over in Canada.
Well, I don't even know. By over, you mean that the
they've gone too far.
Yeah.
Chappelle and Burr have taken the oxygen out of the room. You know what I mean for them? But in Canada, it's going to be a different story.
Well, but what's so interesting is I feel like, and this is, I know we're sidetracking a little, but I'm obsessed with this topic as well. People, I feel like people didn't even listen to Dave Chappelle's special. So for instance,
right.
In the special, he says, I don't think Michael Jackson did it. But then later on, and so everyone hones on that. Later on, he says, I don't know if he did it or not.
Right.
His whole point was, A, the guy died 10 years ago, and all these cases were, some of them had due process, some of them were settled.
Right.
But it's history. And there's, if you're going to spend $50 million on a documentary, there are many more important
right.
issues. So he's, that's really the kind of macro point he's making.
He also points out something that I've been saying all along after seeing Leaving Neverland. Their mothers were star fuckers. He had this reputation.
Yeah, who leaves their kids?
Who leaves their kids with this guy?
Right.
You know?
And I feel like with every bit, the critics took the wrong sentence and blew it up.
And who are you, and you know this, who are you to call this guy a hack? Who are you to even envision what it's like to stand up in front of 2,000 people and not worry about getting a laugh every 30 seconds and building a show from building block A to building block Z and getting off? Go fuck yourself.
Right. And you know, the irony is the first joke he makes, essentially, the first real joke he makes
is about the audience.
Is saying this is what's going to happen. And then he did a show, which you know when he was planning the show, because if you look at the last shows, you see he goes over the line, but he's careful. You know he was probably disgusted with himself from that. And so he said, you know what? I'm just going to go beyond the line. And the first 12 minutes of the show, he describes how he's going to go beyond the line. And then he does it, and all the critics fall for it. But the audience is laughing the whole time. The audience gets it.
I got gay male friends. I got lesbian friends. And I know one transgender. I don't even want to talk about how we met. It's kind of embarrassing. My gay friends hate the lesbians' guts, and the lesbians hate the gays. He nailed that. And that part at the end, the bonus part at the end, where the transgender says to him, you know what, Dave, you're normalizing transgenders. That's what he's doing. He makes fun of everybody.
Right, and don't forget, in his last special, he also says he slept with a transgender.
Right.
He's like a very open guy. He thinks about issues. You know, when he was Will Smith had some show on Facebook about his bucket list where he wanted to, and one of the shows he wanted to do stand-up comedy. So he flies to Vegas to meet with Dave Chappelle to ask for advice. And Dave Chappelle says the most important thing, more important to be interesting than funny.
Right.
And
compelling.
Right. And like you see so many people are just like premise, punchline. You don't get to know anything about them. Whereas Dave Chappelle, he's not necessarily getting laughs every 15 seconds. Sometimes he slows it down. Sometimes it looks
right.
like he's thinking off into the air. He's always interesting. And then I feel actually he's, correct me if I'm wrong, for me, he was an acquired taste. And now he's my all-time favorite. And the reason he was an acquired taste...
He was an acquired taste in his 20s.
And I agree. Because I was listening to him all along. But then you start to appreciate, man, he is doing an act out every single word. Like every single word, he's using a voice. He's doing these jerky motions. You know, he's twisting.
He went from being a dick joker to a prophet.
Yeah.
You watched his evolution.
And you know, same thing is true about Louis C.K. If you look around the 2006 period, he was always brilliant, even in the 90s when I would watch him. He was brilliant at absurdism. He was the best. And he had his observations, but he would always take it in an absurdist route, which was brilliant. But when he started opening up about family, he and then dating, and then finally in the 2017 special about, you know, his beliefs on various societal issues, he also kind of went that profit route. Yeah. I mean, you know, now and then they say he's not allowed to have a career, but clearly if he were to do a tour in the US right now, he'd probably make $60 million, probably the biggest comedy tour ever.
I think that's what's going to happen, by the way. I think Netflix or Amazon are going to offer him a special.
Yeah, and you know, you don't even have to have an opinion on what he did or not. I mean, people have strong opinions either way, but the reality is he's a comedic genius. It's like saying, oh, we're not allowed to listen to Beethoven because whatever.
You know what my thing is, James? Did you deny it? No, you didn't. You didn't deny it. He didn't deny it.
He didn't deny it. People have to look at the time frames.
Yeah.
People have to look at every... because how much power did he have at these times? And again, I'm respectful. Anybody who has an opinion is allowed to have their own opinion. You don't like Louis C.K., you don't have to like him. You know, if you have your own predilections to being whatever, sexually, whatever, don't do it. Or do it, just do what you want. But Louis C.K. is like the best, just in terms of skills. Him and Dave Chappelle, I think, have all the skills.
It's, you know what it is? If you can dig yourself a 7-foot hole and the audience is the one that wants to pull you out of it, you've done a masterful thing.
Right, and that's hard.
It's masterful.
Because you have to, it's like you said, you're trying to manipulate, and that does sound devious, but it's true. You're trying to manipulate an audience to your point of view. So those comedians who can say things that would normally be unlikable but still command the love of the audience,
yeah.
I think that is brilliant. So you have guys like Chappelle now, Louis C.K. on many of his jokes. An extreme case might be someone like Anthony Jeselnik, who specifically wants the audience to hate him and then they love him.
Yeah, but you know what? He's the next one. He's going to be the third nail in the coffin.
That could be.
I think it will be him.
And then there's also, you know, T.J. Miller.
If you're Netflix and you see Bill Burr and Dave Chappelle suddenly get more views than any other special you've ever done, you're going to look for the third one to do it. You're going to go, holy shit, this is amazing. I'm looking for, I need another guy like that or another woman. We need a woman to do it, by the way. We really do need a woman to do it.
Yeah, who? I mean, there's a lot of funny
women. I think Silverman's too thin-skinned to take the chance. I like her. I think maybe Schumer.
Yeah.
Schumer might be
her during the election.
I know. But I think Schumer might be the one who could pull it off. But Sarah Silverman's not too deep down. Sarah Silverman gets hurt pretty easily. I don't think she could handle the...
Here's what I would do if I was Schumer. This would be what I would do. I would do a special called Covers, and I would just cover other people's jokes. Like, just repeat other people's jokes for the whole entire thing. Like, as if she was Seinfeld, as if she was Louis C.K., Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, and just throw it in the face of everybody who just accuses her of everything.
Yeah. By the way, back on Chappelle and Burr, the thing I kept reading is courage, 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 how much courage these guys showed. Now, you're a pretty well-to-do guy. Here's, like I said, I love everything they say. I love everything they think. And I'd watch them forever. But when you're getting 75 mil, it's pretty easy to be courageous. Because you know that if you're told to go away forever, you got 75 mil, right? You got 75 mil. Let me explain this to you. Because I come from Canada, where the most I ever made when I was beating Letterman and Leno was $550,000 a year.
Not the $20 million a year Letterman was making?
I said to them, well, wait a minute. If we have a tenth of the population, can I have $3 million a year? And they laughed me right out of the room. Because God help you in Canada, if you ever come close to making what a vice president at the network makes, you're canceled.
That's why I always made it a rule for myself, never ask for more money. If I was working at a job, never try to bargain for more money than that person is making. It's impossible.
Right.
If you're selling a company, you have to only deal with the guy who owns the other company. People can't help the psychology of money.
Now, here's the other thing you don't know about Canada, because when I told Eric and Jay, they freaked. They couldn't believe it. You know, you think we have the same freedom of speech there you have here. We don't. There's a little thing called the Human Rights Commission. And I can think of three comics who've been brought before the Human Rights Commission for jokes they made in a 120-person comedy club. And as soon as it happened to them, they had to spend $25,000 on a lawyer. Somebody got offended. In one case, it was a lesbian. The other case, it was a transgender person. I can't remember who the other one was. They went to the Human Rights Commission, and in one case, they won, and the comic had to pay them $30,000. Now,
insane.
That's something we got.
That is insane.
That is something we got to worry about every time we set foot on a stage in Canada. I don't even think about it.
So one time, I made a joke about stealing one of my daughter's Adderall. And some guy got up and just started yelling at me, like, "Are you serious?" And I'm like, "What? What's that?" He said, "Are you seriously making fun of a disease?" And I said to him, "I'm sorry, you've been diagnosed with a completely fake disease. But you know, your girlfriend's looking the other way. She's embarrassed. You know, I don't know what you're gonna do." And but then he went up to each person who was laughing and said, "Why are you laughing?" And then he went outside to complain to management about me. They told him, he owns the club. Then he just left. But it is so easy to offend. But to your point, I'm blaming myself, because if I was doing my job of correctly controlling the audience, he wouldn't have been able to do that.
And the other thing I said was, like, that's when, you know, a professional in one of these cases would not have called a woman in the front row a dyke. Just wouldn't have done it. Wouldn't have done it. Wouldn't have called her a dyke. You know, like if it was me, there were two women sitting together, he called them dykes. He got charged. So somebody asked me about it. I said, "Okay, here's what I would have said. Wow, two beautiful women like you. Here it is Saturday night. I have my assumptions, and do you need a ride?" I mean, I wouldn't have called them dykes. I would have called them dykes without calling them dykes. You know, you're still doing it, and the audience gets it. Just don't be so blunt.
So, you know, and again, I'm going to bring it back to your ideas about spontaneity and crowd work and so on. Dave Chappelle, part of his brilliance is, and Louis C.K. as well, but you see this most with Dave Chappelle. It almost seems like he's kind of just making it up on the fly. He's having this totally relaxed conversation with the audience.
On that note, did you hear the cell phone ring? And he said, "That guy's cell phone is gay." Did you see what Vice wrote?
No.
He planted a guy in the audience with a cell phone. Fuck you. You know?
But at the same time, clearly those were written jokes, because he did five shows with all the same
jokes, more or less.
But it always seems like he's talking straight to you. He's just making it up. He's just making these, now I'm going to say that. Like, it seems like he's having a conversation, as opposed to, you can't see, you know, the guy behind the curtain,
right?
You know, who wrote all the
jokes.
And
they criticized him for laughing. And I'm going, well, wait a minute. If he can't amuse himself, how's he supposed to amuse you? I'm watching as a pro going, the reason he's laughing is because he just thought of that right now, and it made him laugh too.
Yeah, and you know, I always think, for myself, I always think when I'm laughing on the stage, then if I'm enjoying it, then at least some large percentage of the audience is going to be enjoying it as well. And plus, I think Dave Chappelle does use it tactically to signal to people to laugh, like the way he hits his knee with the mic,
sure.
The way he backs up. He's kind of like Pavlovian dogs. He's already trained them to laugh at those motions.
Only thing I got to say about the special is there was no excuse for that pantsuit.
Oh yeah.
I don't know what the hell that was.
And he was so cool with the uniforms on the last specials. I was like, really? I actually turned on Sticks and Stones, really looking forward to seeing what he was going to wear and what the closing song would be.
That's why I didn't understand why the transgenders were upset. He's wearing a pantsuit. You know? Be happy.
Yeah, like he's about to go.
He's bringing
parachute.
The pantsuit back for you people.
But, you know, again, though, with you, you really are doing kind of on the fly, thinking up these spontaneous jokes. What happens when you bomb in those moments? Like, sometimes when I have to do crowd work.
Now I'm going to give you the most obnoxious answer ever on that, James.
Okay, let me guess.
I don't know. It's never happened.
I'll go along with it. I'll go along with it. Did you watch Todd Barry's crowd work tour, which Louis C.K. produced, by the way?
Yeah.
Judah Friedlander had a great crowd work tour.
Yeah.
Andrew Schultz just released on YouTube crowd work tour. Yeah. And it's about 36 minutes. It's brilliant. These guys are crowd work I admire most of all, and yet it's hardly ever elevated to the status.
And I'm really
stand-up.
Pissed off because I feel like I missed the boat on it. Netflix Canada better give me one of those.
Yeah, do it.
I want
to
do it.
Just do it and film it and give it to them.
Yeah.
Or load it up on Amazon. You could self-publish a special on Amazon.
That's why I'm going into podcasting. I am so done with network radio and television. I'm done with it.
Well, the numbers on a good podcast are easily going to be over like a lot of TV shows.
Not only that, you're not being called into some 26-year-old asshole's office after your show who's never been behind a microphone telling you what you did wrong.
Right.
Try that.
Yeah.
Like that whole thing with Stern and Private Parts with pig vomit, that's not a joke. That exists.
Yeah.
With these program directors?
No, I know. I lived right next to, growing up in the New Jersey suburbs, I lived right next to pig vomit, so.
Did you?
Yeah.
You know, he wound up in Canada at the biggest rock station in the country, huh? That's where he ended his career.
I had no idea.
That's where he ended his career, yeah. Which was so funny because at the time, that station was carrying Howard Stern in the morning. So this guy had to sit in his office and listen to Howard Stern every morning, and some mornings he was still dissing him. I thought that was hilarious.
So, okay, you get the talk show. Do you have a producer getting the guests? Like, what are you doing? What's your work day?
We had three writers who were friends of mine.
What'd you need writers for?
You know, there were sketches and stuff like that. And, we all went and wrote the few jokes we did out of the paper we wrote together. Those guys had the easiest job in the world. Trust me. And they were friends of mine. So they were always protected. No matter what they did that was inappropriate around the staff, they would come to me and go, this guy's got to go. Nah, I'll leave him where he is. One guy, Lawrence Morgenstern, I know guys down here know him. He's a legend in stand-up in Canada. Most inappropriate, harmless a-hole who ever lived. I made him the head writer just to make him happy, and I protected him every season. At the end of every season, the producers would go, he's got to go. No, he's not going. He's staying. Best thing that happened to me was the band and my band leader, Warren Isaacs. It was the first predominantly black band on late-night television. And I didn't even notice that till somebody pointed it out 4 years ago. But this guy and I had instant chemistry. The day he showed up for them to decide if we were gonna hire him or not, I'd never met him before. So he knocked on the office door, I opened the door, I went not black enough and slammed the door in his face. And I went back in the office. And that from that moment on, him and I were like that, you know, we gelled. I used to say to them all the time, it winds up being 40 minutes. It's not rocket science.
Do you have writers writing monologue jokes for you?
Yeah, we'd go up together and do them. I was always in on it. And I would probably do three monologue jokes and talk to the crowd. And they used to get furious if I skipped one of the monologue jokes. Lawrence Morgenstern used to crack me up because he would write a joke and he would go, we have to do it today. Well, no, we're on 5 nights a week. No, we have to do it today. It's got to be done today. If it's not done today, it's a disaster. I would go, no, we're doing it tomorrow. We don't have time to do it today. But the guests were the problem. It's like Canadians, they would show up and go, well, where's the teleprompter? Where's the script? And I would go, what are you talking about? It's a late night talk show. Oh, it's real? Yeah, it's a real late night talk show. We've been on for 2 years and people would show up and go, where's the script? Where's the teleprompter? I go, there isn't one. Have you got any good stories you want to tell? And then that was the hardest part, getting the segment producers on board. I would go downstairs, ask them about something interesting that happened to them, get them to tell the story. You don't have to tell me the story because I will listen to the story for the first time. And here's what I will do. I will make their story funny. That's all you got to do. And that was the hardest part, getting through their thick skulls, how to do that.
What if they had no stories? What if they didn't want to share with the segment producer a story?
I talked to them about their job and then come up with something there, but...
What was your worst experience?
Margaret Atwood. Everybody asked me, flies right out of my mouth. Margaret Atwood.
Handmaid's Tale.
There's a reason this woman sits in a dark corner by herself and types for 40 hours a week. Unbelievable. Well, worst guest ever.
What happened?
Yes, no. How come you're a guy?
That's what she said?
Basically. Why isn't there a woman hosting this show? You know, Mary J. Blige. She thought my band leader was the host and I was the band leader. When she found out the white guy was the host, she nearly walked. That was the worst. Brian Adams was the biggest asshole. Best guest was John Kretschmann, our prime minister. Huh. Unbelievable.
First off, getting a prime minister
sitting
on the show.
Sitting prime minister.
Right, the current prime minister.
In power at the time.
So obviously that was a huge validation for the show.
Huge.
The network must have loved it.
They loved it.
And were you nervous going in? Like,
this is a big... He was. I couldn't believe how nervous he was. Every time we went to commercial, he was telling me how nervous he was.
How would you make that interview funny?
We came back and he said he was nervous. I said, I smell guest host. Don't worry about it. And by the way, you're on your way to having the time. You know, because at the time his popularity was 20%. And he laughed it off. He was great. He was a real guy. He was just a real person. I could tell he clawed his way to the top and didn't have that much education. You know, I like the guy. I like self-made people.
And you had Louis C.K. on the show as well.
Also great. Did great stand-up. Was fun in the chair. And unbelievably polite downstairs. That kind of threw me for a loop about how polite he was to everybody. That kind of threw me for a loop. Nicolas Cage, who wanted to do it over again, he comes in. He was promoting Wind Talkers. You know, the one about the Navajo tribe, the Indians who were in the army, and they used Navajo over the radios to fool the Japanese. Comes in to promote the movie. So I interview him. It went fine. We go downstairs. He goes, I didn't know this was such a good show. Can we do it over again? I'd like to bring my A game. I go, bring your A game. This thing is live to tape, and it's going to be on the air in about 15 minutes. Good luck. It's not going to happen. Can I come back tomorrow? Yeah, you can come back tomorrow. And then some idiot producer, when he phones the next day, says he can't come back tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh.
I walk upstairs.
You got to fire that guy.
The guy just did Con Air. You said no? The other one was when John Travolta asked to fly in business class, and it was an extra $200, and one of our producers turned him down. I go, seriously?
All right, but that's interesting, actually. Why, like, that's such an obvious yes, that why do you think some people, and probably this producer was a smart guy, you hired him, he's probably educated, he's been in the business. What triggered this stupidity?
Because my budget was 28 grand a night. The biggest concern.
I would take it out of my pocket.
I said I would have. And the biggest thing to everybody was, we can't go over 28. We just cannot go. And 28 included my salary. I mean, I think it was Letterman's green room budget. I think really I was doing it on Letterman's green room budget.
Right.
Like I was going, we're doing this show for $115,000 a week, five nights a week. And you know what I would get from the network? Do you know how much this show is costing? $115,000 a week. In other words, their response was, that's too much money.
Well, how much were they making on advertising?
I don't know. I never knew.
See, you should have learned
that. They
wouldn't
tell you. I tried to find out all the time.
But you could probably have figured what was equivalent
airtime.
I
was doing spots and figuring it out on my own time, and I asked one of the producers to do it, and they got blocked by the salespeople. And when it came out that our ratings were higher than Letterman and Leno, there were two other networks in the country that were carrying Letterman and Leno. I said to the vice president of sales, I hope you're finding out how much they're charging for a spot on Letterman and Leno, and we're charging more. Oh, I never even thought of that.
Oh, my God.
And I was under constant pressure.
So in 2003, you stopped with CTV. You moved over to...
Global.
Right,
biggest mistake I ever made.
Right, so I was going to ask if that was... I mean, you had a good thing going with CTV. You'd been 6 years running, 7 years running.
They wouldn't leave me on all year. And it wasn't a problem for me starting over again after being off the air for 4 months. But it was a problem for everybody else to gel and get used to their job again. So my thing was, I want to be on all summer. I want to be off for 3 weeks in August like Letterman and Leno do, but I want to be on all year.
Could they have maybe given you like a variety show or something to keep you occupied?
They offered me a special once and I said, no, I don't want to do that. It's not what I do.
Yeah.
I do this. The other thing you got to worry about in Canada, James, is overexposure. If you're the guy who's on everything, people get sick of you real fast.
Huh.
I said, my thing has to be this show and this show only. This is where I want people to come to see me, and it's the only place they're going to see me.
So,
I don't want to do anything else.
Do you think I guess there was publicity around you moving from CTV to Global. Do you think that hurt when you relaunched, you know, the Mike Bullard show on Global?
What hurt was the guy who was the owner and founder of Global is the one who wanted me to come, and then he died.
Oh, no.
A month before I went on the air, and the two dumbed-down versions of him took over.
So.
By the way, it was a classic. Chris Cuomo might have got mad about being called Fredo, but this was classic Michael and Fredo. The youngest brother was in charge of the network. The oldest brother wasn't. So I used to call them Michael and Fredo behind their backs. And it was just bad news. Then they made the older brother the executive producer of my show. And I knew I was in big trouble because he comes up to me 2 weeks before we debut and he goes, I want you to sing the monologue. I go, what? He goes, I want you to sing it. I go, what do you mean, like show tunes? He goes, yeah, I want you to sing the jokes. We'll have the band back you up. No one's ever done that. And I go, let me explain to you why no one's ever done that.
Okay, and I guess it doesn't need to be said why you couldn't go back to CTV. Probably there was a bridge burned or whatever.
Yeah, bridge burned, but I don't mind burning bridges. You know what I mean? I don't mind. The deal with me is you can be holding a bag with $1 million in it, and if I don't like what you want me to do for it, I'm not doing it.
Do you miss, even though you said you wouldn't do it again, do you miss those times? Like, that sounds like it was a great, fun time. Doing
I miss the beginning, and I miss the middle. I don't miss the end. Hmm. You know, I don't miss the end because...
too many tensions?
Things happened. Like, the person who didn't change was me. And that's weird. And plus, when you're the one who's supposed to have the drug and alcohol problem and be pampered by everybody, and you're the one who doesn't have it, and you're the one propping up other people who do, plus you got a show to do at night, you kind of go, shit, man, this is exhausting. You know?
Yeah.
And an open door policy, I never should have had it. I understand why people who host late night talk shows eventually go nuts and become really insular. I understood completely why Letterman behaved the way he did. And I understood completely why Leno pretended to be the most open guy in the world, but wasn't.
Why is that?
Because everybody comes to you with every little concern they have. And they can't get it resolved by the producer, so they come and knock on your door and bitch at you for 15 minutes.
So how do you solve the problem? Do you have to delegate to, do you have to train the producers to solve
the problem? I used to go, listen, man, you got to take care of this. And then finally, they wanted to have a meeting, and they had a meeting and told everybody they could no longer come to my door. And then the crew viewed it as, well, Mike doesn't want to talk to us anymore. So then I had to have another meeting and go, listen, I do want to talk to you. I know your names. I know your kids' names. I know your wives. I just don't want to talk to you about the fact that they didn't give you a pillow for your seat on your crane cam. I don't want to talk to you about that. I want to talk to you about your family, your friends, anything. But I don't want to talk to you about the fact that you're a cable puller and somebody stepped on your cord last night. I don't give a shit. You know, here's the thing. I'm the little circus pony. When the light comes on, I'm supposed to make everything all right. When the light goes off, I'm supposed to go home just like you.
So the Mike Bullard Show on Global ran for...
Jeez, I wish they called it something else.
Ran
consider
for,
how long it lasted.
What did it do, like 100 episodes?
Yeah, 100 episodes.
Which is like half a year or less than that?
Less than that. But by the way, 100 episodes of anything in Canada is still huge. I did 1,200 at CTV, but even 100 at Global was some kind of record.
And then since then, you've been doing radio and stand-up.
Yeah.
You've been having fun?
Been yeah, you
living
know what?
On, living mostly, life on your terms?
Yeah. Mostly, yeah. Yeah, mostly, yeah. But like I told you, I was real excited to come here, and I'm real excited to be doing my own podcast because I've done two of them, and I'm sure you've done other things too. I never felt this liberated. Like, it's liberating.
Yeah, it's great. It's you could do whatever you want.
It's the weirdest feeling in the world. Like, I had a guy in who was Jimmy Hoffa's driver. The guy's 85 years old. By the way, it's still in post-production because we're trying to get the clicking of his dentures out. But... fascinating stories. The guy let the guy go on and on and on and on. Didn't have to worry about somebody saying, hey, we got to take a break.
Right.
Did an hour and a half with the guy. It flew by. And the stories were amazing.
Plus, this I feel like there's things that happen in a podcast that don't happen in a radio show or a TV show. One is you can go in depth. You can't talk for an hour with someone on a TV show or a radio show. The other thing is... you could have on whoever you want that satisfies your curiosity. You're allowed to be curious. You don't have to just like respond to, some promotional event that's happening and now the guy's doing the rounds of shows, like you're referring to, like you'll see somebody on Letterman and Leno and Kimmel or whatever.
Yeah.
And then also you're actually providing a service to the audience.
Where you're also coming closer to what Stern does. Like, people talk about how masterful Stern is at interviewing, right?
Yeah.
But basically what it comes down to is he kind of treats those interviews like a podcast.
Yeah, he's curious. That's what I noticed. He's legitimately curious.
Yeah.
Like, what the you read the new book, Howard Stern Comes Again. It's just transcripts of a bunch of his interviews. And just reading those, you get to see this is a master at work. It's like kind of a master class in interviewing. Yeah. It's a brilliant book. And he's the best interviewer out there.
It's funny, I read, Larry King's book on how to interview people before I started doing the talk show. I was reading everything I could get my hands on that particular subject. I didn't get anything out of the Larry King book. But I read Howard Stern's book with the interviews too, just like you did. And I went, wow, man, this is pretty amazing stuff. This is almost like a text, you know?
Yeah. Ever since I watched Private Parts in, what was it, like 97, I've wanted to do essentially a podcast. Even back then, I was doing, as 1997, I had a job where I would wander the streets of New York City at 3 a.m. and interview any prostitute, drug dealer, or whatever I could find.
Right.
And put the results up on the web for HBO. It was like a web show even back then. And that was probably the funnest job I ever had. And it was inspired by going to see Private Parts and also inspired by the show or the book, The Late Shift, which described the late night wars.
Which, by the way, hit a lot closer to home than either Leno or Letterman admitted, I think.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
I think so.
Bill Carter's a great, great writer. Yeah. I love all his stuff. Yeah. So you have a podcast now. Tell us about that.
U2 podcast with Mike Bullard. Kind of a play on Me Too, I guess. I didn't come up with
hashtag
the title.
#U2.
Yeah, #U2. And it's in Toronto. It's in a great studio space. It's kind of like this, really. And it's just people. I mean, the great thing about it is it's just people on that I find interesting. Ben Dichter is the producer, and he will run people by me, and I'll go, you know what, that person sounds kind of interesting, and I've seen that person before, but I've never seen all sides of that person, and that's what intrigues me. Let's get that person in. How many do I have in the can now? 2? Oh, he's not even here.
Yeah.
Great. That's great. You know what? That's what I call a wonderful partnership. Guy doesn't even stick around for the whole podcast. How many have I got in the can? 2?
2.
Yeah, and a guy I'm interviewing next week is the guy who started a new political party in Canada, and everybody's scared as hell of him, Maxime Bernier. And I'm going to be interviewing him next week. And the reason I'm looking forward to it is that I'm not a journalist. I'm not going to be unfailingly polite with a politician. Like, I want to get down and dirty with this guy and find out what he's really about and what he's going to do for me. Like, I'll tell you that I had the prime minister, 4 years ago on my radio show, and I got in such deep shit, I thought I was going to lose my job because he came on election day, and I said to him, started talking about all these issues. I go, when's the last time you filled up your own car? And you wouldn't have believed the heat I got after. But the public that day saved my ass because they all went, it's about time somebody asked that question. He could not answer the question, and he did not know how much gas was a liter.
Yeah, that's
which
like
is what we have metric system, by the way. You're the only country in the world that doesn't have the metric system.
We have the correct system. That's why.
Yeah.
What was the thing with George Bush once where they asked him about shopping, and I forget, he didn't really know how to like move
George
shopping.
George Bush Senior, right?
Yeah, the senior.
Yeah, I don't know. It was something. You know, what are the price of diapers or something like?
But
that.
But what about Bill Cosby not knowing how to use an ATM?
You know, by the way, that interview, my polls went down 3% that day. Thank you very much.
Your what?
My polls in my riding went down 3%.
Hey, can I go to the bathroom?
Yeah,
I don't
want
to confess to anything, but I got to go to the bathroom.
well, we're about to finish. Can I do a closing comment?
You bet, whatever you want.
So, Mike Bullard, check out his YouTube podcast. I know, you know, you've had this 30-year career in comedy, which you've translated into talk shows, radio shows. You've reinvented your career so many times. It's inspirational. You've done what you've wanted every step of the way. And thank you for the lessons on crowd work.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
And shout out to Aaron Berg for, like, really making this happen. Like, he put it all together.
I I can't tell you how thrilled that my name was uttered in a New York comedy club to a bunch of people who have no idea who I am.
Last night, he was like, is James still here? Mike Bullard's in town.
Which meant nothing to anybody.
It's okay. There was only like 8 people in the club. Yeah, okay. Aaron Burke headlining, his dream come true. All right. Thanks a lot, buddy. Mike.
Tito's handmade vodka had been mixed with its fair share of cocktails. But one night, a chilled glass topped with lime and cranberry would change everything this bottle knew about happy hour. From the producers of America's favorite vodka, it turns out the cocktail you've been waiting for was right there the whole time. The Tito's Rum Cosmo. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll sip with Tito's. Coming to cocktail parties near you at Tito'sVodka.com. 40% alcohol by volume, namely 80 proof, crafted to be savored responsibly.